Hey guys, if you know me, you know I love to travel and you know I love to save money. This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further. Literally. They cover all things travel finance, like how to plan group trips that don't bust your budget or your friendships. How to maximize points for real savings, not just free bottled water. How to avoid paying for upgrades you won't use, and so much more. They're doing great work over there. Check it out. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Travel Tales Podcast. The winners are the people with the most stories.
One of the great things about traveling is the people that you meet.
I've slept in bus stations, I've slept on people's floors.
And it's already on fire, and then there's just a gigantic, huge explosion, like out of a Hollywood movie.
It's not right or wrong, it's just different.
We hired 10 Chinese prostitutes to come be our audience.
We were kidnapped by nuns in Puerto Rico.
Not a good idea to be high when you're packing. You forget a lot of stuff.
I got swine flu.
By the time you've lived through it, it's just a good story.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Travel Tales Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Siegel. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Alex Bogard. And before we get to Alex, here's a few announcements. Our website is traveltalespodcast.com. Go there and then you'll find stories that I've written, stories that some of the guests have written. You'll find links to their social media. You'll find links to our social media. That is, of course, Travel Tales Podcast on Instagram. Follow us there. Get those numbers up, will you? We have a Facebook page as well where you can follow us. Most of you listen to us through a streaming app, probably Apple Podcasts or maybe Spotify or iHeartRadio, whatever it is. Please subscribe there and maybe even give us a good rating because that helps more people find us by boosting our presence. And that's a cool thing for you to do. Cost you nothing. And I appreciate it. If you think you'd be right for the show or maybe you know somebody right for the show, be a good guest. Or you want to write me and ask travel questions or just tell me I'm awesome. You can write me at traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. That's traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. Alex Bogard is a photographer, but didn't start out that way. He was born and raised in Europe, traveled extensively as a child and as a young adult. And while he traveled, he thought, maybe I'll start taking some photos. So we took a lot of photos. And as he showed them to people, people got impressed. But still, he kept his day job. Eventually got married to an American, moved to the Seattle area, where he remains today, raised a son, but never stopped traveling or taking photos. And as time went on, he realized he had an eye and a gift for photography. And people started to want to buy his photos. And he's done everything from landscapes to people, animals, nature. You name it, he shot it. People have purchased his work, businesses, publications, and he continues to travel. He's headed to Malaysia on an assignment next year. He's an interesting guy, so it was a pleasure to meet him, and I hope you enjoy our chat. Here's photographer Alex Bogard. Alex Bogard, thank you for joining us here at the Travel Tales Podcast. Bogard, and with two A's, that sounds and looks kind of Dutch, is it?
It is Dutch.
That's exactly right. There we go. Are you born there or family from there?
Born in Switzerland.
Switzerland, okay.
But half of my family is from Holland and the other half is from Belgium.
Lovely.
And so I still have family all over there.
And how about your childhood? Where did this all start?
So for me, it started in Switzerland. And then in the first 14 years, I bounced around 6 different European countries. So very sort of Europe-centric, yeah.
Well, certainly if you're going to be involved in nature or shooting nature as a photographer or hiking in it or doing anything, Switzerland is the place to be. It's certainly a great place to start.
It's a beautiful place to start, yeah.
Is that where you got your photography start?
No, my photography start didn't come until much later in life. I've been around it because my father used to do that really as, you know, like everybody does, which... although back then in a different way, the small little video movie cameras with the 8mm film and then normal camera lenses. But being around somebody who documents what they're doing, my parents are certainly, I would refer to them as adventurers and travelers, and they love to do that. And in fact, still to this day in their late 70s, you still can't pin them down. They're somewhere.
Good for them.
So I was exposed to that then.
Sure. And so I can imagine being so centrally located in Europe and having traveled so much in different cultures throughout your life growing up, that planted the seed, right? I mean, to see other worlds. Yeah.
No question. I mean, by the time I was, when you mentioned languages and cultures, by the time I was 14, I was onto my fourth language and all the cultures that come along with that, right? That sort of shapes who you become.
Right. Was film more or less your kind of like first dream? I mean, for a lot of photographers, a lot of them want to make movies as kids. I mean, is that what you were looking for, or was it always kind of like the still image?
Well, for me, as I said, it was later in life. I probably was in my late 20s when I started doing it a little bit sort of more deliberately and intentionally. And for me, it was photography first. It always seemed to me that the video side is that much more complicated to do than a photograph. And I figured, well, get this right first before you tackle something else. And so I've just stuck with photography this whole time.
Was it your study, like at university or something? What did you go after?
I went to grad school in Paris and graduated with an MBA. I've been in the business world my whole life. I still am. And photography is just it's a side track, a parallel track that kind of runs parallel with what I do.
How many exhibitions would you say you've had around the world in various galleries?
Exhibitions, none.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, nope, none. But I have pieces that are hanging on in various places around the world. So I have pieces in New Zealand and Portugal and Puerto Rico, and then a number of them in the U.S.
So here you are, you're in your 20s, you're a young man in the business world. What kind of business were you doing?
I was and still am in the insurance business.
Insurance. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Very different.
Yes, I was going to say. And so now you're, I'm assuming you're traveling through all this. You probably never stop traveling, as, you know, those of us who love travel, you never quite stop.
You never stop. Right.
Was it a thing where you were taking photos along the way and you found that you had a knack for this and a gift?
Correct. So what came up is essentially the leading element is the traveling for me. It's always been sort of travel centric. And as one does when we're in places that are really, really different to where we live on a daily basis and we see things that are just amazing on this planet, you try to capture that, if nothing else, for your own recollection and memory, right? And then you bring it back home and then you show a friend or two or three or four and you gauge people's reaction. There's an experience that goes along with that. And so it's one way of bringing the world that is one part memory sort of for me, but also one part documenting what's there and bringing it back to other people who can't and haven't experienced it. And so over time, the gratification that comes from the reactions that people get to them is what sort of gives me fuel to go back out and do it again. Because where I like to go takes effort. It takes preparation. It takes effort. It's off the beaten path. If there's a line anywhere, generally, that's not my cup of tea, right? So I know I tend to be in places where you won't find that many. And so that makes the interesting part of bringing that back to people sort of really interesting. And then after that, it's just practicing and getting exposed to other people's work and seeing where that sits in relation to other people's work. And, you know, one day you wake up and you think, well, maybe I've got something, right? Maybe there is – somebody seems to like it. So,
well – I'm in my 50s, and you and I are both men of a certain age, and we predate a lot of digital photography. Correct. And everything. So what kind of gear were you taking on these early trips?
Back then, I mean, it was either a Nikon or it was a Canon, but it was film. It was 36 millimeter film, right? And you would pick your ISO setting based on, you know, the environment you were going to be in. So you know, I might shoot 100 millimeter film if I was out in the desert somewhere, or it might be 600, 800 if you're somewhere darker, cloudier, that kind of thing. Types of film you would choose would depend on whether it's going to be print photography versus slide. But the advent of technology really, I think, and the way one shot back then, because you had a roll and you had 36 and that's what you had, and you couldn't see what the outcome was going to be until yeah. much later, right? It really changed the way we shoot, I think. And I think in some way it's bringing us a lot of resources. In other ways, I think when you know you've only got 36 exposures and you can't tell whether it's going to be until you've left wherever it is, you tend to be careful.
Yeah. Well, I think about it now. The first time I left out of the U.S. was after university, you know, doing the 6-week backpacking yep. tour around Ural Pass, you know, around Europe. And
yep.
I found that album that I had, and it's, I think in total in the album was about, in 6 weeks, about 58 photos. And now that's a day. Yeah. That's a day now, you know, shooting and, you know, on your camera, on your phone. So yeah, you had to be pretty selective. And I'm amazed to see how unselective I was, just like a field yeah. in, you know, somewhere. And I didn't even know where it was. It was just, but man, yeah, we were very selective, especially we didn't have any money for film. You know,
well, that's right. Because I mean, it's expensive. Then you're paying for somebody to develop it. Now we don't, right? You shoot it and you put it on your computer, and
yeah,
your cost doesn't go along with it. But
well, also we, you know, we were before the advent of social media and the internet and things like that. So when you came back with all these great photos, how did you get people to see them? Was it just family members? You brought them to your house, had a party, and had a slideshow?
It was immediate. It was exactly what you're saying. It's exactly that. It's the slideshow that, you know, somebody puts up in the back of the living room. You close your curtains, and you got you yeah. and six people are watching it, right? And that's the universe. And in some cases, it might even be smaller than that. It might be the photographs are taken, they're put on these sticky pages with the film over the top, and
yep.
and then you hope they don't yellow.
Right,
you know, a year or two later, and that's that book gets shoved away on the shelf and it moves on. So our world has really changed, obviously, I think, in many ways for the better in that regard, but it's a different world now.
Have you gone back and digitized a lot of these early ones?
So great question. So one of the very first trips we did was for four consecutive years in a row with my family, we went and did a Trans-Sahara expedition. So crossing the Sahara Desert, North Africa from north to south. And my dad, this is now late sort of 76 to 79-ish kind of era, right? And all of that was slide film. And this is now 50 plus years ago. So I'm about to embark on grabbing all of those slides that's in that period of time and since then have been in attics, in boxes, moving trucks, exposed to dirt, humidity, and all kinds of stuff that they shouldn't be exposed to. And I'm going to try to grab some of that work. My father is still around, and so I'm going to work with him to maybe grab a selection of them and bring those back to life and see if we can get them into a big format setting.
Oh, yeah, we found that in my grandfather's, you know, house when he passed, and he was a big yeah. slides guy, you know, so yeah. we had a lot of stuff from the 50s and things like that. And, you know, again, he could have been more selective of what he shot a photo of, and we wouldn't digitize all of them, but some of them we definitely wanted to. And that was a big COVID project for me, going through those old albums and digitizing that's, stuff.
That's great. So I'm about to embark. The box is literally in transit and DHL something or other
yeah.
from France right now to here. Hasn't arrived. It'll be here in a day or two.
And we also found my childhood, like Super 8 films. You know, they have no sound. But thank God I digitized those, because they were just sitting in Florida in my mom's attic and they were going to disintegrate. You know, I mean, so is that a... That's got to be a major problem for you guys. Some of these things, unless they're in the right temperature or in the right place, they're going to get ruined, right?
We'll see.
Oh, gosh.
We'll see. Oof. We'll see.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of material there. And I'm, you know, even if it's a handful of sort of really quality images that we can bring back a little bit, that'll be, and if it's not perfect, I think that adds to the character of it.
Yeah, and I'm so glad I got the chance to share it with people. Now we have a YouTube channel for our family films and stuff. So yeah, it was kind of cool.
Awesome. That's awesome.
So you talk about like Africa, going through Africa as a child. Have you been back since to those same places you went as a kid? And how has it changed? And what were your big memories first of going to Africa as a kid?
Boy, the memories were... First of all, I think the way my mind thinks of them today versus when I was that age, I mean, we're talking, you know, my first trip, I was 6. The last trip, I was 10. Are two very different worlds. On a human relationship standpoint with locals, and locals would vary very much depending on whether you're in city environments or out in the middle of deserts and you're bumping, or more to the point, the Tuaregs are finding you, not the other way around. And they approach your camp and they're on these enormous dromedaries and they're just beautifully clad and imposing looking. And then they come down, and if you imagine yourself on top of a dune so big that when you look back down, the Land Rover you stepped out of is the size of a matchbox. And then you look 360 to the horizon, and all you see is horizon 360 to the end, just this infinity of sand, right, as an example. And in the middle of that, coming unheard, unseen in the approach, a lone Tuareg will come out of there and come up to your camp, have his animal go down, which is a dromedary, is a huge animal, and with nothing, we'll start a little fire. We'll put a little teapot that he's got in the leather bag in this thing. We'll put mint leaves in it. We'll put the little bit of water that's hanging from a goat skin on the side of the animal, and we'll make you a cup of tea. I mean, that part of it is just incredible, right? And you're basically, your mouth is open down to here and then eventually it's like, okay, goodbye, we're done, and it moves off and disappears, and you never see him again.
Wow, that's amazing. Did this kind of like go from the top, from like Morocco across, or where did it go?
No, so we did good question. So there were 4 different trips. One track was from Morocco in the north and then south.
Oh.
Tunisia was another one, and then Algeria was another one. And Algeria went all the way to the, basically to the Niger border, which, you know, that's a 2,000-kilometer one-way trip.
Wow.
Through that, yeah.
Through Land Rovers?
On Land Rovers.
Oof, wow.
And often Land Rover singular, often we were completely alone.
Oh, my God.
Which... Okay, my father and I have had multiple conversations about that. Now, you know, I'm an adult with my own child. I'm going, what were you thinking?
Right. No GPS. No
GPS.
No phones. No nothing.
Zero.
Wow. Man, that's what an experience, though. Yeah, I mean, so many.
Amazing.
You never get that.
Amazing. And again, you know, at the time you appreciate it in a certain way, but now when you look back, and this was before the political climate changed.
Right.
And so those places today are very different than they were then. And it wasn't very many years after we had gone that it was basically unsafe to do that, those trips
sure.
again.
Was it still being controlled by the French at that time, pretty much?
They still were in part.
Yeah.
And that's changed a ton too.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But once you got deeper into the deserts and start approaching that Niger area, anything could happen to you.
Yeah. Wow. Wow, that is exciting. What kind of line of work was your dad in?
So he was in the fragrance business. So he worked for an American company. It was headquartered out of New Jersey, and they moved him around every 2 or 3 years in Europe. And essentially that business manufactured the smells you have in detergents or toothpaste.
Oh, okay.
And or... perfumes and so on and so forth, right? So they manufactured those essences. That's what that business did. And so like me, though, he would do this in during the day, and then we had a whole other life. And the two personalities were different. The one side is the suit and the shirt and the tie and all that. And then the other side is, no, we can get down and grungy pretty quick.
Right. And you say you're a father now. How many kids?
I have the one. Yeah,
yeah, one kid. Okay. Yeah. When you look at how you were brought up and then you see your child, I mean, sure, you must have wanted to show them the world, but I mean, you know, you're not reckless. I mean, do you think we were crazy back then, you know?
There was a level of risk there that was, and I'll give you a quick story just to illustrate the point. So you mentioned no GPS in the desert, right? So the maps constituted essentially these enormous rolls that were probably about 3 to 4 feet wide by 6 feet long. And when you would unroll it, it was essentially a big sheet of yellow. There was nothing there. And in the middle of this thing, so we had a stretch of the desert to do where you had to choose between, do I carry enough fuel to get across, or do I carry enough water to get across, but I can't do both. Which do I pick, right? My father picked, I'm going to carry enough fuel, based on the idea that on this map, there was a little circle that is maybe 1/8 or smaller of an inch wide on this whole big unrolled map. And that was a well. And if anybody's ever done any navigation, when you talk about dead reckoning and needing to be on the dot, not 100 yards to the right of it, over hundreds of miles worth of distances, right? And being on the dot, and if you miss the well, you're done because you run out of water, right? So I asked my years later in my adulthood, I said, what were you thinking? Well, the odds of you hitting that well dead on with compass, night navigation, and that's it, and this map, which basically in my mind was worthless. There are no roads. It's not like you're on a road and it takes you from A to B and follow the signs, right? His response to me was, oh, I wasn't worried that I wouldn't find the well. I was worried that my rope wasn't going to be long enough.
To get a bucket down the well?
To get the bucket down low enough. And I'm going, you're flat out crazy. So no, I didn't do any of those things with my son. Not to that extent. But exposing him to different cultures and different languages and different ways of being and looking at the world, we did do that.
God, driving solo through the desert on a Land Rover. And you have to worry that the car won't break down. You know what I mean? Just, I couldn't fix it if it did.
Neither. He can. I couldn't either. So there's a skill set that, you know, in order to be able to do things like this, there are all these layers you have to think about in any kind of traveling. But when you go that way, you have to be a navigator. You have to be a mechanic. You have to be good at first aid. You have to be the kind of person that can make something out of, you know, a spoon, a knife, and a ballpoint pen.
Right. Was he an old army man? Was this
I'm not that guy.
Was he an old army man that you know, maybe he had no fear in him?
No, he wasn't army at all. It's just, I don't know. It's just some people are just wired different.
Right. So you're traveling around and you do this and you take these photos and people start to see them. You know, you start to show them to people. Who was the What was the first time you sold a photograph?
So I came out, as it were, in the sense that all of my photographic work for the vast majority of my adult life stayed with me. It was never put anywhere, largely because I never thought my work was good enough. It was fine for me and my own consumption, but I was like, it just, you open any magazine and there's just a plethora of jaw-droppingly beautiful photographs. I'm like, what am I going to do here, right? And then about 7 years ago, I went to a master photography course, essentially a master class type of thing. And I walked in the room, and there were 30 students in inverted quotation marks, and there were 13 faculty, and the faculty were editors of Nat Geo, editors of Outside Magazine, career photographers, staff photographers for Nat Geo and Set Magazine, photojournalists, Red Bull photographers. I mean, the thing, I walk in and I'm like, what in the world am I doing here? Because everybody in the room was either actively trying to make a living with photography or making a living with photography. And I had nothing. I had no website. I had no portfolio. I had nothing. I had just me and my little computer. And part of the exercises that we went through every day, we would go on shoots every day. And then every day we had to present by a deadline, three photographs that we took that day. And then they would get put up in an auditorium in Jackson Hole. And the students were told to go sit in the front rows. And then there were three, four rows of empty seats. And then the faculty in the back. And the instructions were sit down, be quiet. We don't want to hear from you. We're going to present this work randomly and anonymously. And we're going to critique them out loud. And I thought, I am going to get destroyed here. I'm going to get destroyed. I'm literally the kid in the back of the class that has no business being there. And so I would watch other people's work and go, God, that's really good. And then hear the critique and like, I'm totally going to get destroyed. And then my work came up and it actually got good reviews, good comments. And that's when I went, oh, okay. I actually can hang here a little bit. And so from there, I sold my first piece, I want to say maybe I kind of got my affairs in order, if you will, sort of website presentation, that kind of thing. And I sold my first piece 2 years ago, 3 years ago now. And I now have pieces, as I mentioned, from New Zealand up to here. And I feel fortunate that people are spending thousands of dollars to buy an image, which heretofore I've always thought completely and utterly inconceivable.
So this was only a few years ago?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Post-pandemic?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. I used the pandemic to get ready, now that you mentioned that. Yeah. Use the pandemic to get ready and then post-pandemic, yeah.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So yeah. Now that you got some momentum and you've built this website, yep. You just go through 20, 30 years of your photos and just put them up?
Or there's a whole bunch of them that just aren't worth a damn.
Okay.
and so they would fall in the category of put them in your but what I do typically with the customers I've been fortunate enough to work with, it's a very collaborative process. The website is really just a place to get a sense of style and content and options. But usually what will happen is then there'll be a conversation that I begin with them and I start asking the kinds of questions you're asking me of them and what they're hoping to see and what moved them in life and what are the things they're drawn to. And they said, well, I saw this on your site and was interested in it. I try to dig a little bit deeper as to what is it about that drew you? And then from there, and with that definition, I'll go curate a list of or a series of 6 to 10 to 12 different options that are sort of in that genre. And then I'll present that to them. And so each one ends up being a bit of a custom thing. The arsenal of photographs I have are not readily visible to everybody else.
Right.
So I go and draw and then come back and say, here are 10 things that other people won't have seen before. What do you think? Am I on the right track? And then they'll tell me if I'm on the right track or they'll say, no, you hit it. You nailed it. And I'd like to get this one.
Okay. So these are all past photos that you've done already and you curate them for other people. Have you been hired to go shoot new stuff for clients?
Yep.
Who was the first one to hire you and gave you an assignment?
Yep. I'll keep his name private, but this particular gentleman is an entrepreneur in his own right. And he started up and built a fishing company, and which he then sold. And he, to this day, is drawn to the outside world and the elements and loves to fish. And so I went and spent 3 days with him, photographing him while he was fly fishing up in Northwest Washington and in the Ho National Rainforest. And I sat 3 days on my separate little boat in the rain, watching my gear get ready, called just documenting and cataloging that experience for him. And then we came back and same thing. I went through the work and presented it to him, and he's grabbing the pieces that he likes, and we, you know, it's a really fun experience. So that's a highly customized thing just for them.
So shooting people or landscapes and nature or animals, what do you prefer, or do you have a preference?
So the photography world, as you may know, or probably do know, loves to silo photographers by discipline, right? You're a food photographer, you're a portrait guy, you're a wedding person, you're this, you're that, you're this. Coming from the business world, we hate being put into silos. We want to say, okay, where can we meet a need? And so for me, I feel like I'm at the stage in my life where I'm not ready to be siloed. So I started with landscape and wildlife. I really enjoy that environment for a variety of reasons that actually precede the taking of a photograph. It's just being out in the elements. It's kind of nature for me is where my church is, right? That's where I go to find my, but when I went or go to places like say Cuba, or if I were to go back to Morocco, there's such a human story to tell. That there, the human photography is really interesting, right? And so I'll do that, and I enjoy that a great deal too. Very different, but potentially very rewarding.
How willing are a lot of? I mean, certain cultures have a tendency to be more private; they don't want their picture taken. Mm-hmm. How have you bridged that? And has somebody ever gotten hostile with you and said, hey, no photos?
So in reverse order, hostile, not to the point of confrontation, but that I've had a couple of moments when somebody looked at me and raised a finger and made it really clear, did not want, right? So in terms of how do I do that? First of all, before I ever leave and go there, there's preparation on the culture. So I'll do a little bit of self-educating to understand, is there a cultural issue with photography? Is there a religious issue with photography? What, you know, that.
Is there a government security issue? A police issue with the photography?
It might be those. So I'll have that level of awareness. Then one of the things I never do is just point a camera at somebody uninvited. And so the approach tends to be, first off, I try to communicate in the language. Start there. My camera is hanging around my shoulder or my neck, but it's not active. And I'll engage in an exchange with that person. And so it'll be if it's in Spanish, it'll be a little bit in Spanish. If it's something else, then it might be, if I was in, for example, Turkey, I would grab a little bit of German, a little bit of French, a little bit of English, and between us, we would figure out a way to communicate always. There's never a moment where you just can't communicate, really. And you build a rapport. And when somebody makes an effort to be respectful, number one, number two, you approach gently. You don't stick a lens in somebody's face. If somebody did this to me in my driveway here in the US, I wouldn't be happy with it.
Right.
So why would I do that in a foreign country? I mean, that's just disrespectful, right? And I might take 10 minutes and you might never get permission, right? I've had moments in Cuba where that exchange, all of that took place in 30 seconds. And the person looked at me and said, sure, go ahead. And so, boom, it was click, click. And so there's a lot of that, right? And then finally, what I try to do in some of the cases is offer to give them later a copy of what I took, right? So part of sharing back. So if it's a mother and two little kids, you know, walking along a railroad track, and I like the shot, if I get permission to do that, then I'll take the shot and then I'll piece of paper, take down an address, whatever, or if they have a WhatsApp account or something, I'll do that and then send the photographs on later.
Okay, well, I've been in certain places where it's like, you know, the kids especially, they loved it. You show them the image that you just took of them. Yes. Oh, do they love it? Because they've never seen themselves, usually, a lot of them, you know.
Yeah, I'm usually there. And then, and often I'll be the guy on his kind of on his knees almost on the floor, and I've got a gaggle of kids all the way around me looking at the thing.
Sure.
And they're too young at that point to say I want a copy. But I've had instances, for example, where I might have photographed young street kids who are dancing in the street. And so I'll have, by young, they're 15 to 21, let's say, right? And they're accomplished dancers already, but they're just doing it in the street. And so if I'm shooting them, even in remote places, it's absolutely amazing how wise and savvy they are to technology. And they have WhatsApp accounts. Sure. And so they go, send me this thing on WhatsApp. And I go, okay, so now I've got these connections with these kids in Cuba where I've sent them their photograph that then they can use to post on their own social media and whatever else. The world has become a lot smaller because of those tools, right?
So
I try to share it back.
So now you brought it up, the social media. We've seen that aspect of our lives come and go, or not come. It's still here. How did you embrace it? Have you embraced it? Are you on Instagram? Do you prefer one or the other? What's your deal?
As you pointed out earlier, I'm of a certain age, so I've embraced it much more slowly.
Yeah, me too. I'm right there with you.
So I am on Instagram, and it's taken me years, but I'm finally on WhatsApp as well. And I have found that medium, in terms of communicating directly with somebody, in getting things to them, or just inquiring how they are later, that kind of thing. So I still communicate with a young lady boxer in Cuba, whose photograph I had taken, and I had shared it with her. And then out of the blue, her photograph is hanging in my studio here. And I said, I wonder how she's doing. And so I sent her a little note, and she wrote right back, and she says, hey, I just had my regional championships, and I came in first. And then in the nationals in Cuba, I came in second. And then I wrote a little note with a little Olympic logo that said, maybe this in 2-3, whatever the time frame is. And she writes back and says, that's my plan. So here's this young person I met who is one of two women in a boxing studio full of boys ranging from 4 to 20, early 20s, training. And there were two women training in there. And in an environment where they have nothing. I mean, food is an issue. Power is an issue. The banking system doesn't work, et cetera, et cetera. Infrastructure is literally crumbling around them. These kids find a way to have energy, find a way to have a purpose, and just have grit and go after it. And it's just fantastic to see.
Yeah, I've been to Cuba once. I made it to Havana for about 3 days. And I had, as an American, I had to go through Mexico to get there. And this early 2000s. And I found it, what a fascinating place. You know, I don't know how many times you've been back, but it was just like time stopped in 1959. And people ask me about it. Hey, how was this? How was the food? I go, well, the Cuban food will probably be better in Miami just for the fact that they have all the ingredients.
No question.
You know, because they don't have many ingredients. Everybody's pretty poor, but they make do with what they have in a way that, you know, is kind of inspiring.
Well, I learned when I was over there, and part of that preparation, mostly if you're employed, you're working for the government. If you're working for the government and you're lucky enough to have a job, the average wage is $15 a month. 1-5.
Yeah.
A month, right? So we will spend in one meal what they will make in a month. And so when you then are in that environment and you look at the abject poverty that's there, and yet despite that, there is such a vibrant energy, such a such color, such just enthusiasm. They get out in the streets and they play music and they just suck everything out of life that they can, because the easy part of the things you and I take for granted just aren't there for them.
Yeah. Right?
And I don't want to romanticize it, but that ability to create a life out of so little and create joy out of so little is something I think we've don't have quite in the same way,
despite
absolutely. All the resources, and maybe because of all the resources that we have.
How many passports do you have?
I have just the one.
Just the one?
Two for a hot minute, but just the one.
Oh, are you a U.S. citizen?
I am a U.S. citizen, and when I chose to do that, I had a Dutch passport. And the Dutch basically said, look, you can choose, but it's going to have to be a choice. So if you want to go that way, then you have to turn your passport in.
Oh, okay.
I turned my passport in.
And now, which ones be more valuable at this point? It's pretty interesting.
Well, that's a different podcast.
Yeah. So, what brought you to America, and how long have you been here?
Oh, it's what brings any young man right. from one end of the world to the other, right? If it's not a lady, probably my question.
Ah, there we go.
Or maybe a love,
money.
Love story.
Money too, your job.
Well, money too. Yeah, in my case, it wasn't that. I had nothing.
Okay.
I had nothing. And so, and she had nothing. So that wasn't it. We actually were married in Europe and initially intended to live there because that's where I'd gone. But she was from the U.S. is from the U.S. And, you know, and my comfort level with going different places is different than hers. And at some point she said, you know, I living in Paris is fun, but I want to go home.
Yeah.
And so we came home, and that was 33 years ago.
Okay. And she's from the Seattle area?
Yep.
Okay.
She's from the Seattle area.
How do you like in Seattle? I'll be up there a bunch this summer because I'm going to be there next week because of I got to work on a cruise going to Alaska. So I got to get
there. Oh, yeah. No, yeah. No, I love it. I mean, the critique is that it's wet.
Yeah.
And my response to that is that's what Gore-Tex is for. The plus side of it all, I don't know how many places you can go to where in the span of an hour's drive, you will have ocean shores, mountain ranges, huge lakes, deserts. If you go east of the state, you've got such a variety up here. And it's just beautiful. And it's very green, which is part of the byproduct of having more rainfall than you do where you are.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, I always love, you know, visiting there. And, I remember I just happened to be there a couple of weeks ago and, you know, I'm down there by Pike's Place Market and I look over and I can see Mount Rainier right there. I mean, it was snow peaked and it was, clear enough to see. And I was like, wow, that's pretty impressive. I got to say that looks really great.
Yeah. So you were lucky because what we say here locally, we say she's out.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like she was out that day, which is not a given. She's not always.
Oh,
out.
No. I've been there a number of times. I haven't seen it like that. So that was that was nice. I happened to be there in a nice day. So how about your worst photography experience where you were on the road and just everything went wrong? Did you ever, like your film got exposed or everything got washed out by rain or anything?
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give you a bit of a bizarre answer.
Okay.
Or might seem bizarre.
We like bizarre here.
Any worst because the way I approach photography and because it's travel centric, it's the trip first. And to me, in my mind, the photography piece, if it happens, it happens. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. And I'm okay with it. So I have had moments of frustration where I feel like I'm just not inspired. My brain's not in the right space. And I might be somewhere that has the potential of being beautiful, but I'm not seeing it. I'm not having any success capturing it. So that's more of a limitation of me than it is the environment that I'm in. So to the extent that my trips have by and large been good, it doesn't mean they work to plan, but just the idea of being out there when something actually doesn't work to plan, that's what adds the adventure to it. I've not had any bad experience. I've had blasé experiences where I go to a place, I won't name them just because, I mean, they're sort of dotted all over, but you'll go to some place that other people love to go to and they say, hey, you really need to go to X. And then I get there and it's essentially one gigantic t-shirt shop and, you know, bars trying to outcompete each other and noise and a bunch of people from where I come. In fact, there are more of us there than there are locals, you know, that kind of thing. Those are things that just I'm not drawn to at all.
That was going to be another question I love to ask, is a place that didn't meet your expectations and a place that exceeded them.
All the places that don't meet my expectations are the places that fit that bill.
Right. That's what I figured.
It's basically been turned into a tourist trap, right? So take your pick. They're in Mexico. They're in Hawaii. They're in Europe. They're in everywhere. Take your pick. Within that, places that I have really found amazing for different reasons. The one that I still think about is my recent trip to Everest Base Camp.
Oh my God, I'm going there in October. I booked my tickets.
Good for you. Yes.
I'm still debating whether to do the full hike or not, or just do some sightseeing and see Tibet.
No, hike it. No, don't fly there. Because you'll miss everything, right? Here's what's interesting. Well, first let me ask you a question and then I'll take that detour about flying versus walking, because I did both, it turns out. I found the Khumbu Valley, which is that basically the valley you hike up to go and hike up to Everest Base Camp. I found it to be deeply spiritual. The landscape is on a scale that dwarfs anything I've seen. And the proximity to it, it's all around you. And we're talking about, you might be walking at the bottom at 15, 16,000 feet at the bottom of a little valley. And for as far as your eye will see on both sides, you've got these enormous peaks that come out of the ground. And they're another 13, 14, 15,000 feet above you. And they're right there. And it's not one, not two, but dozens of them. You know, the closest thing we have here in Washington, you mentioned Mount Rainier. Well, Mount Rainier is by itself, it's gorgeous. It's by itself. The hills around it and the mountains around it are much, much lower. And you have one of them. And actually in the state, you have a handful of them. But if you look at Mount Rainier, you just see the one. Over there, I'm at 15, 16,000 feet. And there's another Mount Rainier right here, but it's straight up. Everything that you see up there, infrastructure, buildings, wood, pots and pans, jugs of water, all of that made it up there either on some animal's back or some person's back. Everything. A few exceptions here and there where for big things they might use a helicopter, but that's super expensive, so they tend not to do that, right? The air is different. The sound, the way sound travels is different. The people are really different in a wonderful way. So I found that. And then you step into yet another world, which is the monastery world and the Buddhist monks that dot the valley and their lives over there. And I feel that is a place where I still have unfinished. It speaks to me. I'm like, oh my gosh. And yet I feel like I haven't seen any of it yet, really. So there's layers to it. Back to walking versus flying or taking a helicopter ride. So we walked it and we went from beginning to end. And then right before we left, I thought, you know what? Let's take a helicopter ride and fly back up the valley and back down. The out and back for us was 100 miles. The altitude difference from start to end, my high point was 18 to 24, something like that, right? Starting point was just above 9. So not a ton of, I mean, yes, it's 9,000 feet. But you did that over 9 days on the surface, you go, well, that's not that big of a deal. The elevation change to get from that point to that point and elevation gain we had to hike was 22,000 feet because the trail is like this. It's like a stock market graph. And we got on the helicopter and flew to base camp, overflew it, came back, and the whole out and back trip was under 30 minutes.
Wow. Well, that's a lot easier than hiking it.
Right. And we had spent 9 days schlepping our way up there and back down. And so that's why I say hike it, because you won't see any of those things. You won't feel any of those things if you fly it.
When did you do this?
This October will be 2 years ago.
Okay, good, because they did tell me that October was a good month to do it.
October was when I went. I'm really glad that I picked that, because the options are basically May or October-ish. And May is, I mean, it's still busy in October, but Basecamp has 5,000 people in May at Basecamp. You know, we had, when we arrived at Basecamp, there was one tent.
So how did you do with the altitude and the elements?
Overall, pretty good. I had two nights where I thought I might not make it because I was struggling with breathing and the amount of oxygen intake, or lack thereof, I should say. So I had two nights that were difficult. But other than that, it went actually really well.
How about food poisoning or anything like that? That's pretty common up there.
I had one little run-in that was a day of... Yeah, okay, so it wasn't poisoning, but, you know, you have the runs for a day, and I was lucky it was just a day. You got to be careful. And in my case, I did something stupid. I was in one of the places where there actually was a shower, and the showers are basically fed by these black or aluminum tanks that are on rooftop, but the water comes from you have no idea where. And as I was rinsing my head, I let the water flow into my mouth before I spit it out. And I didn't swallow it, which is probably why I only had a day. But if I had swallowed it, I might have been the week, right? So that was just silly. I mean, it was so obvious not to do, right?
So how about bucket lists? Where are you dying to go to?
There's lots of bucket lists. I've done a bunch of traveling on my enduro motorcycle. And those are, it's kind of maybe the junior version of what my father was doing with Land Rovers, right? We're still out there. You're still, you know, 10 days out in the backcountry, but you're using a mode of transportation that is essentially, it's all off-road. And, you know, we live in a country that's just absolutely flat out amazing just here in the US, and the amount of territory to explore and the variety that we have, there's just so much at the doorstep. And so there's more of that I want to do. I've done sections. There is it's called the Backcountry Discovery Road, which basically goes from Mexico all the way to Canada. And that's like 85 to 90% off-road. And so I've done sections of it. I've done the Utah section. I've done the Oregon section, the Washington section. But one of the trips I'd really want to do is go back and do that, but from start to finish. So that's one. I've not traveled extensively in Latin America, in deep South Latin America. So traveling that back up, Tierra del Fuego and Argentina and Chile would be amazing.
So you've not been to Patagonia?
I've not been to Patagonia.
It's a photographer's dream down there.
See, all these places to go to. Yeah, there's a lot more. I've gone to southern Argentina, but that was to play rugby. So I didn't do much. Not much by way of photography, but it reminded me that you need to get back down here and go do this.
We touched on a little earlier how technology has really changed the game in, well, everything, but especially photography. Now you got your Photoshop, you have filters, you have AI. What's been your reaction to this, and how do you use it at all in your work, or do you stay away from it?
Really good question. I've very intentionally stayed away from some of them, and I've adopted what I would call sort of the equivalent of what you used to be able to do in a darkroom. So here's what I mean by that. I don't use Photoshop. And by the way, I should preface this by saying this is not a judgment thing at all on anybody. For me, I like my work to be authentic, meaning I've either had the skill as a photographer to capture what I needed to capture in the frame directly in the camera, or I didn't. So where I draw the line is I'm not going to add things that were not there, and I'm not going to remove things that were there. So for me, that's a hard no. And I borrow sort of that discipline from the photojournalism world, where for them, that's a career ender. You go document a scene and you come back and this thing, and I don't know how they do it. Somebody did this in that class I was telling you about. They photoshopped a yellow line in the middle of a road out of a picture. And instantly, that faculty back then saw it. I couldn't have seen it in a million years. They were like, this thing's been edited, and they stopped the whole class and they put the lights back up and said, what happened down here in the lower end, right-hand corner of the photograph? And so I like the discipline that comes along with, you have to work with what's there. You don't get to create it or create something that wasn't there in the post world. So I tend to not use, in fact, I don't tend to, I don't use Photoshop, period, end of story. I will use Lightroom. Now Lightroom goes, now I can, so now what are we talking about? I will play with colors a little bit. I might brighten something. I might darken a little something. I might crop something. But that's about the extent, right? It's color, it's size, scale. It's about it.
Well, we're all dealing with technology in every industry. And is there something in you that is worried that, oh man, we're going to be replaced, especially when you see these AI images?
It certainly can, right? And there's a, you know, there's a argument that says, who needs a photographer? You can, in a few keystrokes, you can tell AI and say, create this image, right? And they're all around us. In fact, if you're on Instagram, you'll see them, right? And they're beautiful pictures. To me, they still look like manufactured pictures. I feel like I can tell, right? So for the vast majority of people, that's going to be just fine, and that's okay, right? The question then becomes, is the person who is going to buy my picture the same as the person who's satisfied with an AI-created image? And is the person who wants a 5, 6, 7 foot tall picture photograph in their home the same as the one that says, well, I want this for my computer application or whatever else, right? And probably not. So for me, I shoot for my own pleasure first, right? And okay, if somebody decides they can get it more cheaply by doing it on AI, then I guess go do that.
When you go somewhere, are you strictly the guy with the handheld all the time? Or do you, you know, every so often pull out the iPhone and start snapping photos like the rest of us?
That's a really, really good question. So for me, so it's usually my travel buddy, he's the guy with the iPhone. And so think of Everest, I'm the guy schlepping 40 pounds of gear up the mountain. Right. And so, and he's there, click, 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 cool as a cucumber, you know, no extra weight. And I'm huffing and puffing because I'm dragging all this gear around. I think the iPhone in and of itself is actually a remarkable tool. It's actually stunning what it can do. So I think that's really cool to have. So I have mine too. That said, the quality of what you can get with glass and the more robust cameras is just different. And on a computer screen this size, probably tough to see. On a phone, you won't be able to tell the difference. You take that picture and you blow it up to what's behind me, one will work, but the other one will fail miserably. It just won't work, right? And so there's a difference. And most of my work tends to be bigger.
What are some upcoming trips you have planned? What's next for you?
So I've got a custom shoot up here in the mountains for a customer coming up here in about a month. And then my next one, there'll be other little things in between, but my next sort of bigger trip is to Malaysia. And there I'm going to go do something I've not done before. So I'm traveling with a Pulitzer Prize winning photojournalist. And the object of the trip in this instance, which is a first for me and probably more what you're familiar with, is I'm going to go there to develop a photo story. And what I've shared with you so far is it's been the other way for me. It's I travel first and then the photos come out of the trip, not the other way around. This will be sort of learning to plan a trip and think about access and what connections do we have to build ahead of time to be able to have access and what's the story you're going to investigate and document. And I've never done that before. I'm not a journalist, so... So that'll be different. So that's my next one. That's slated for late January, early February of 26.
Well, let's get business out of the way. Where can people find you and see your work?
Yeah, so they can find me on the website, which is www.alexbogard.com. And they can find me on Instagram, Alex Bogard as well. And I'm a phone call away or quick text away, and my cell phone is on there, and somebody has any questions or wants to talk. If you want to talk about a trip and how to get ready for your Everest trip, call me.
Awesome. Well, I'll ask you my favorite question that I ask every guest on here. How do you think all this traveling that you've done and all the places you've seen, how has it changed you as a person and how you look at the world?
I'm not even sure where to start on that one. I mean, the question would be, how has it not changed us, right? So when we, without wanting to go too political, if we are and remain insulated people, we tend to view the world and any number of subjects in a very sort of binary fashion. And the world just isn't made up that way. So the more I travel, the more I get into places that are uncomfortable, the more I learn about other languages. Languages, in my mind, are the gateway to culture. And if somebody hasn't done that before, start with things that are easy and more approachable, like go pick a place where the language is common, but yet there's a richness to it that's different. So, for example, if you are born here in the U.S. and you've lived your entire life in the U.S., go to Ireland, go to Scotland, go to New Zealand. Make it easy, right? So you get off and you're not completely sort of decountrified, right? You don't have culture shock going on, but there's a richness that's just different from what we're used to, right? In the same way that they would be thinking, God, I want to go to the America and I want to see what the cowboys look like, right? Right. So it's the same thing the other way around. So start there and get comfortable with just the language and then start branching out from there. But being around people who live their lives too and have some very similar aspirations to what we have or similar challenges to what we have, right? And then watching people as I've done, whether it's in Ecuador or if it's in Mexico or if it's, you know, living with a very, very small fraction of resources that we have and yet do so much with it is such a good reminder for us. I mean, it's just, you know, it brings a little humility. And I think if I can bring a little humility in my own life, it probably doesn't hurt me, right? Hopefully it makes me a little bit of a better person. I still got ways to go, but every little exposure, every little insight is just, to me, it's enriching.
It's great. Alex, thank you so much for doing this. Everybody out there, go to alexbogard.com. That's with two A's in Bogard. And follow him on Instagram and check out his work. Alex, thanks again for doing this. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
For spontaneous travelers, winging it is the perfect listen. James Hammond shares stories and tips from 75-plus countries. Find it at voyescape.com.